We will start off by opening a work session on Senate Bill 247. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 247 would repeal the sunset on the statute that requires the University of Oregon School of Law and PSU's Hatfield School of Government to provide dispute resolution services. This bill would distribute the funds from the dispute resolution account in the amount of 65% to the University of Oregon Law School, 35% to the Hatfield School of Government for purposes of dispute resolution responsibilities. And there are two proposed amendments before you.
Thank you. We will start off with a panel consisting of Greg Wolf from Portland State, Jane Gordon from the University of Oregon, Jenny Carmichael from the University of Oregon, Amy Cleary from the Oregon Association of Community Dispute Resolution Centers, and Elaine Hallmark from the Oregon Consensus Program at PSU. Welcome to the committee. I apologize for being late today. It's the first time I've been late all session, and I had to pick your day, so I apologize. And can I open a work session? Oh, I want to correct the record here. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 247. I guess you might, that was a Freudian slip based on my opinion of this bill. So we will not put the cart before the horse. We will open a public hearing on 247. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I'm Greg Wolf, the director of the National Policy Consensus Center at Portland State University. Today, this panel represents the University of Oregon School of Law, the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State, and the Oregon Association of Community Dispute Resolution Centers. All of these entities are non-court dispute resolution programs funded with a dedicated dispute resolution from the dedicated dispute resolution account. Just a brief historical context. In the 2003 legislative session, the community program and the public sector mediation program was transferred to the two universities from the Oregon Dispute Resolution Commission with a sunset clause attached to it to see how they would work in the universities, in the university setting. We're here today to report to you that the programs are doing very well, and you will find a letter with our testimony from the University of Oregon President A. Frohnmayer and Portland State University President Dan Bernstein encouraging your support of Senate Bill 247 and continuing the delivery of these programs through the universities. Your committee introduced Senate Bill 247 to remove the sunset and allocate revenues from the dedicated fund to these programs. There's an information sheet also attached to our testimony that describes the bill in more detail for those of you who want to delve into some of the details. As Joe mentioned, there are two amendments that have been introduced, both of which we support. However, one has some language issues that we want to address to the committee. But the first, the first one is the allocation from the dispute resolution account to the Judicial Department to fund some of its court-related mediation and arbitration programs as a one-time amount. After that allocation is made, then 65% of the remaining funds will be directed to the community dispute resolution.
Mr. Wolf?
Yes.
Can you just make sure we have the record? You're talking about an amendment, but we didn't ID which amendment that is, just so we can make sure the record's straight.
I believe it's the dash one.
Okay.
Amendments. Yeah. And there's an issue with this amendment that I'll address in a minute. The second amendment clarifies that there will be coordination between the public sector mediation program and the Department of Justice. And that amendment has been included in your materials. I believe it is the
dash three amendment.
And that amendment has been worked through between the Department of Justice and the Hatfield School, and we are both supporting the language attached to that amendment. With respect to the amendment, the dash one amendment, the issue that we have with the language that's here in the dash one amendment is that the $800,000 that would be transferred to the Judicial Department would be a one-time amount, and so the language that refers to the 2005-2007 biennium should be attached to sub one under 4A. With that change, we also are supportive of that amendment. We've worked with the Judicial Department on the language there as well. Just want to make one final comment. The two universities and the Oregon Association of Community Dispute Resolution Centers have really collaborated very well together. And an example of that is building the capacity of those local centers to identify and assess cases that are in the communities for their suitability for mediation. We've conducted a training in conjunction with the community programs, and we also have assessed a series of cases around the state working in collaboration with the community centers. And we're just very excited about this working relationship because we believe that it's going to expand our capacity to do this work all over the state. And so now I'd like to turn it over to Jane Gordon from the University of Oregon Law School, who has been a great partner for PSU and really helped us work through this. All the issues that are surrounding this program over the last couple of years.
Thank you. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I'm Jane Gordon, Associate Dean of the University of Oregon School of Law and Director of the Appropriate Dispute Resolution Program at the law school. Since 1989, the state of Oregon has really been a leader in out-of-court dispute resolution, and we're very happy in the last legislative session that continued, and look forward to the continued support by this committee and this session's work in bringing this forward. I don't want to give a lecture on mediation, but I think it is really important for the members of this committee and who probably already know how important alternative dispute resolution has become in the state of Oregon. Mediation has provided a way for courts to be able to manage their growing caseload, slowing the increase in court filings. It's been important in stemming the tide of unnecessary lawsuits and really giving citizens of the state a way to resolve disputes in a more creative, less expensive, speedier way. This Senate Bill 247 gives this committee and this session an opportunity to continue that work. The speakers who follow will give you some specific examples of this kind of work and the support that's important for these programs to receive to continue the work. And first, I'm very happy to introduce Jenny Carmichael, who was hired by the law school after the last session to establish and manage the Oregon Office of Community Dispute Resolution.
Welcome to the committee. Great. Thank you very much, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. I'm going to speak to you this...
If you'd identify
yourself. Yes. I'm Jenny Carmichael, the administrator of the Oregon Office for Community Dispute Resolution at the School of Law at the University of Oregon. And I am going to speak to you this afternoon from the perspective of having the role of administering the funds that are associated with this legislation that go to the 20 dispute resolution programs throughout the state. It's been a great opportunity to work with them, and my function is to ensure that those funds are spent well and also to help the community programs be as effective as they can be. In the past year, to give you an approximation of the dollars that we're talking about $500,000 from this fund went to 22 centers around the state. We have looked at some of the research around community programs, and I wanted to share with you a couple of things that I thought might be of interest to you. One is in about 20% of our cases in the community programs are juvenile victim offender cases. These are cases where a juvenile has committed a crime. You're going to be hearing about one of them today. What we're finding in the research is that there is far lower recidivism for juvenile offenders who go through these programs. The Juvenile Department Directors Association across the state for that reason has endorsed Senate Bill 247. They would definitely like to see these programs continue because they are such a strong support to the juvenile court system. You will also be hearing from one of our police chiefs in Hillsborough today. Research in this arena tells us there are fewer police follow-up callbacks when mediation is used as an intervention when there is a dispute. So it's this kind of program that makes a huge difference. A couple of other important things for you to know about this bill, and it's continuing from 1989, that the monies that are collected in a county go back to that county. So, for example, Clackamas County, whatever is collected there goes back to Clackamas County. Another really important thing to know about these programs is that they are intensely volunteer-based. And as I looked at this data in the last couple of weeks to share with you, it is really quite a phenomenal investment that you're making with this program. $500,000 a year, and more than that in value, is raised in volunteer time that's contributed to these programs. We work with our economics department at the university. They value an hour of a person's time at $17.33 an hour as an average Oregon wage. And with that, there is more raised in volunteer time than actually comes from the state of Oregon to these programs. One other thing I would like you to know, and that is the importance of this funding to these community programs. It is their core funding. We would see many of these programs go away in the state of Oregon. We would see the option of mediation, alternatives outside of the court, go away in most of the counties in the state of Oregon if this bill does not pass. I would just say, given that the return on investment of these programs, and also from a policy perspective, financial policy-wise, this is a good decision to pass this bill, and I encourage you to do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And I would like to introduce Amy Cleary. Ms. Cleary is the president of the Association of Community Dispute Resolution Centers in Oregon, and also is the director of the Clackamas Dispute Resolution Center.
Thank you, Jenny. Honorable Chairwoman Burdick and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I thank you for allowing us to appear in front of you today. I am serving as the president of the Oregon Association of Community Dispute Resolution Centers, and I also am employed as the program supervisor for the Clackamas County Dispute Resolution Center. So I have the unique perspective of running my own program and also interacting with people who are doing this similar work throughout the state of Oregon. And we would appeal to you today to please...
Could you identify yourself? I'm sorry, for the record.
I didn't say it. I apologize. My name is Amy Cleary. And what we want to be able to do today is request your support for Senate Bill 247. As Jenny was saying earlier, it is vital to us that we are able to maintain our sustainability of this work through getting state funding. The state funding is not the only money that we get to do our work, but it allows us to leverage other funds from government agencies and other grant funders so that we can stretch out our funding base, so we can really diversify our funding base. And that's why the state money is so important. It's not the only thing that sustains us, but it is something that's a key to being able to attract other money. And we do run our programs very efficiently because we have so many volunteers that come to these programs. We have we train hundreds of volunteers a year, and thousands of volunteers are in our pool of people who come and help resolve disputes at the community level. We're also participating with PSU, with Elaine Hallmark, who you'll hear from in just a moment. The Oregon Consensus Program is helping us not only to train and mentor people in community mediation, but also in public sector mediation, so we're able to do more multi-party work. And these kinds of issues are coming to us more and more in our communities because people are seeing the need for collaborative problem solving in their communities as they face development issues or issues around annexation, many of the kinds of things that are coming to us now. Are requests from people who really want to find alternative ways of resolving those multi-party cases. So we're happy to be developing that capacity. The put my glasses on here for just a second. Our collaboration, the administration piece that's been set up since the last session has worked really well for us. We've been collaborating with the U of O, who's been the administrator of the money that comes to the community programs, and that's worked very well. Jenny Carmichael has been helping us to kind of organize all of the community programs, and the association has been able to focus the work of those community programs so that we can support one another and expand our offerings to the state of Oregon. And we also have been collaborating, as I said, with PSU in doing more public policy work. We had a training session where 27 volunteers and staff came and did an assessment training with Elaine and Greg's group at PSU. And we were also able to, since then, begin to work on some pilot projects. There's one in Eugene. There's one in Clackamas County now that our program's involved in. and these are beginning to pop up around the state, so that we're able to really get out there through the community programs and see how we can help people support collaboration in the public processes that they're involved in. We have, in the beginning of the life of the community programs, in 1989 there was one mediation program in Oregon, and now we've got 20 that are serving 28 of Oregon's 36 counties. As I said, we train hundreds of volunteers, and many of these people are either coming, well, they're coming from all sorts of places. People are attracted to mediation as students through the universities, as people who are retired that are looking for meaningful work to do in the community, and people who are looking for just valuable tools to add to the work that they do, either in the public or the private sector. So we're finding that people are taking these processes out and really applying them in their lives. We are able to address issues with businesses, with business owners, coworkers, consumers, neighbors, parents, and teens, and anyone that comes to us to ask for assistance. We spend time on the phone with people. We talk to them about what their issues are. We really help them explore what their options are. Mediation isn't the answer for everyone in every situation, but we do want them to be able to take the time to assess which option is going to be best for them. And often they find that mediation can at least address a part of the dispute that they're involved in, if not the whole thing. The people who participate in mediation are building understanding, they're promoting respectful and constructive problem solving, and creating stronger community bonds. Mediation builds understanding, promotes respectful and constructive problem solving, and creates stronger community bonds. On behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Dispute Resolution Centers, I respectfully ask for your support of Senate Bill 247 so that we can continue to perform the work of community and public sector mediation throughout the state. And I'd now like to introduce you to Elaine Hallmark, who is in charge of the Oregon Consensus Center at PSU and who has been so helpful in helping mentor us.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I'm Elaine Hallmark, and I am the director of the Oregon Consensus Program at the Hatfield School at Portland State University, and I'm pleased to be here this afternoon to tell you a little bit about that program, which is the other one in this bill. We are the continuation of the state's program to address public policy issues. We provide services statewide directly out of our program, and our primary focus is to serve as the neutral that convenes the parties, that gets the parties to the table in these often complex multi-partied kinds of cases around the state. We address everything from legislative issues. We've actually been sent things by the legislature in the past, such things as the fish passage policy. Is an alarm going off?
It was a cell phone.
Our first dollar for the committee.
This is a very bad day for Senator Ringo.
Are you getting penalties here?
We need some mediation quick.
Right, okay. Okay. Well, I was just saying that we do sometimes do legislative issues. I think you know about those. We've done things. The program in the past has done everything from fish passage legislation to prepaid burial plans that have come, been worked out in a collaborative agreement and then come to the legislature to be supported by all the parties involved. We do similar kinds of work sometimes with agency rulemaking or development of agency policies that are going to affect numerous different parties. There have been projects on gold mining and seeding waterways, and one underway right now on aggregate mining on farmland, and a wide variety of things related to land use, development, all sorts of public policy kinds of issues, transportation, workforce issues, education, human resources. And the hardest part and the biggest role I think our program plays is that upfront role of helping people understand that they actually can work things like this out, even though they're very complicated, large numbers of people. It can be managed and structured in a way that we know is really helpful and most likely to lead to development of some kind of an agreement. Just a quick overview of what we've been able to do. The program in the past had resources available through both the Oregon Dispute Resolution Commission and some dedicated to it through other agencies and staff. It had resources of about $1 million for this program. In the last biennium, when it was sent to Portland State was given only $125,000 in administrative dollars and no actual program funds to fund the mediations themselves or the or these upfront assessment things. We have been able, with that money, to stretch it and to leverage and bring in some grant monies and other monies. We have done about 25 cases so far in screening, assessment, and so on, and we had about 10 of those be able to get into mediation or some other collaborative process. In the past, the program with the larger budget had done about 100 in a biennium of cases going into mediation and probably 200 or more that they gave advice to. I'll give you two real quick examples of what worked and didn't work in this last session, and one is I've been authorized to share about the Mount Hood Meadow ski area because a lot of people are aware of that area. It's been a center of conflict for many years about its development issues. It had one case in the Court of Appeals this year that was an appeal regarding a land trade. They came to us for help in figuring out whether they could mediate that. We were actually able to help them figure out how to approach that case and how to bring in a few dollars. We got the county, Hood River County, actually came up with some money to help fund it and get it started. And they are very near an agreement, which they all say is the first time they've been able to reach an agreement on this. They're going to move into a broader mediation that we are going to help them get started to look at their longer range plans in a large number of disputes. On the other hand, Senator Ringer and Senator Beyer are gone, but I know on last week when they were in Hood River, they heard about a case in Wallowa County regarding the Nez Perce cultural lands. And there's been a development dispute related to that. We had some involvement early on trying to help address whether that situation could be mediated. We were unable to come up with the resources. We had no resources to bring in a mediator and actually start that. That case has actually gone through LUBA, through the Court of Appeals, and is back and has now become a ballot measure 37 claim. So it's an example of one where maybe if in the right time we'd had the right resources, we might have been able to avoid that. It's never sure. So we are hopeful that if this measure passes, if Senate Bill 247 passes, we can actually restore the level of services that we've had in the past, even though we will be operating on with less resources overall, but we think we can actually meet that. So with that, I'll just open it up to questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Pazansky?
Madam Chair, I guess I just want to follow up on what Mr. Wolf started off with as to, and Ms. Gordon also shared about the Dash 1 amendment. My reading of it, I don't think it's in conflict. I actually think it fits right in, because if you look at the bill itself, the Dash 1 actually modifies Section 4. Section 4 uses the language that's on the Dash 1, starting on line 7 to the end, and basically sets the framework for how the distribution will go, with the exception of the 2005-2007 biennium, which is in Section 4A. So I'd like for you all to look at that, because I think that 4A actually says how the money's going to be distributed for only 2005 through 2007, and then after that biennium's over, you fall back and default to Section 4, which gives the 65-35 split without having the first $800,000 going to the courts.
Joe is not after we finish with this panel, what I will do is volunteer the services of Mr. O'Leary to go over what Senator Pazansky should be commended for a very good catch for if we're able to actually handle that today.
Thanks.
Are there other questions from the committee? I think we've all seen here. I mean, it's a pretty amazing thing. I just have to give you all a few kudos before you go. This all started out with the abolition of the Dispute Resolution Commission last session, and to take a fairly catastrophic event like that and to, out of whole cloth, cobble something like this together that really works and to get everybody's agreement on a very short timeline,
It just goes to prove that when the going gets rough, bring in the mediators. You did a fabulous job.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment, and we're happy to work with Mr. O'Leary on this. The concern that we have is that we are able, again, because of some carry-forward money, some unallocated funds, to have made an arrangement with the courts to have the $800,000 this year. It isn't sustainable past this biennium that all three of these processes will get funded through this fund. And so we have committed with the courts to keep working on this issue until the next biennium, until the next legislative session. But that's our concern, is getting this language correct, because our agreement with the courts is that it is for this biennium that the $800,000 will still come out of this account, as it did in the last biennium, but that we will continue to work together to figure out a solution that can be more permanent.
That's correct, and that's a sense that I get from the courts as well. And of course, you know, at the end of the day, the budget process is an entity unto itself.
Right.
We can do our best to make sure that this program gets the support it deserves, and that's why we're here today. So
thank you
very much, and I will call up some other witnesses, and then we'll get word on whether it is indeed a solution, and if so, we can act accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Brody.
Next, we have Merle Kelly. Yeah, I think we will. I think we'll bring up a panel. Merle Kelly, John Bawit, and Chief Ron Louie of Hillsboro. Welcome to the committee. Why don't we start with you?
Thank you. My name is Merle Kelly. I am president of the board of directors of Neighbor to Neighbor, which is the Marion County Community Mediation Services. And I'm going to read a letter from one of the people who have been served by our agency during the last year. This is in support for Senate Bill 247. Dear Chair Burdick and members of the committee, last year my adult daughter and I were shot by the infamous Salem drive-by paintball shooters. We were walking in my new neighborhood when we heard several loud popping noises. I felt a sharp pain in my left hand and watched in horror as my daughter screamed, put her hands over her eyes, and crumpled to the ground. I looked up to see a blue van driving by with a hand waving out the window. We went to the closest house for help and were relieved to find the wounds were minor. My hand was cut and bruised. My daughter later received treatment for a superficial scratch in her eye with no permanent damage. The trauma and the anger were the more lasting result of the incident. As we learned from the police and the newspaper, a group of male teenagers got together after school and drove to different parts of town, shooting randomly at pedestrians and bicyclists. How could those little rats do such a thoughtless and mean-spirited thing? For sure, they must be the worst juvenile offenders. Next stop, prison. I felt angry, violated, and victimized. Several weeks later, I was contacted by Salem Neighbor to Neighbor Mediation Services to see if I would be interested in participating in a victim offender mediation program where I could meet face to face with the young men to explain to them the impact of their actions. The meeting was to be facilitated by a trained volunteer mediator, so I agreed to participate. I arrived at the prescribed location wearing a full coat of righteous indignation. I was going to tell them a thing or two. The mediators explained the process and ground rules and made sure questions were answered. The mediators explained they weren't a judge or a jury, but were giving us the opportunity to talk face to face with one another in a safe setting. The purpose of the mediation was to give the young men the opportunity to hear how the incident impacted us and the community at large. The important point is what a powerful and healing experience this was. I completely misjudged these young men. They were mostly healthy, loved, successful young high school boys, who made a terrible mistake in judgment by getting into a blue van on a sunny afternoon with not much else to do. They did not intend to do harm. They simply thought it might be fun. They were very mistaken and paid a high price for their poor judgment. Because of the opportunity to meet these young men in a safe and healthy setting, I was able to see that the boys were sincerely sorry, ashamed, and quite frankly worried that their awful mistake would have lifelong consequences, such as not being able to graduate their class and attend college after being held in juvenile hall and expelled from school. I was able to meet some of the parents, to shake hands with the dad who had tears in his eyes, and to hug the crying mother who was heartbroken by the experience, heartbroken for the victims and heartbroken for her son. The young men learned a valuable lesson in that room. They learned that wrongs can be righted so long as you face the consequences, admit the mistake, and make amends with the person you harmed. I watched these frightened boys take steps toward manhood in that very room as they asked for and received our forgiveness, recognizing that their lives could begin to move forward again. Without the Salem Neighbor-to-Neighbor Mediation Service, we would never have had the opportunity to be heard, to forgive, and to reconcile. Now, instead of being filled with anger and fear, I hold these young men in fond memory and would make myself available to give them guidance should the need arise. We need to continue funding this valuable service. Where else can we as community members find a safe and professional venue for resolving disputes and building community relationships? Thank you for your thoughtful attention to this important matter, Kathleen Poole.
Oh, thank you. That's an inspirational story. Appreciate that. Are there questions or comments from the committee?
Madam Chair, I agree with you. It's a very inspirational story, and it just adds to what you said earlier about how this program came from abolition to success, and this is the reason why. Thank you.
It is. Okay, Mr. Ballwit, a friend of Tom Anderson's, I believe.
That's correct. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is John Ballwit. I'm from McMinnville. I'm the owner and manager of the McMinnville Grand Ballroom and some other commercial real estate in town there. And I've been involved in commercial real estate for almost 20 years now. So I've had, I hope only my share, but my share of disputes with tenants and the contracts. This fall, I had what looked like it was going to be a particularly ugly dispute. It was a problem with somebody wanted to sell their business, and there was a subleasing arrangement and some things that weren't satisfactory to me, and things weren't working out for them. And in a small community like McMinnville, these things are complicated as well, because the same person who was the owner who was trying to sell their business is also... his kids go to the same school as my kids, and their best friends live next door to each other, and there are all these other connections. I was very eager to find a really effective solution to this problem that would really minimize the ill will that could and so often does kind of erupt from these kind of business things. It's just a kind of an inherent part of this sort of business that there are these kind of misreadings and differences of opinion on contracts. So I was very fortunate, actually, as we were having this dispute, as the dispute erupted, we were out on the sidewalk, and it just so happened that somebody I knew who was a mediator with the program walked by, and I said, "Help us! how do we get into mediation?" And we were able to quickly set up a mediation arrangement, which and for the tenant, this was it was very critical that this thing all be resolved very quickly. So, overall, I guess I'm here because it was a resounding success. We had we very quickly were able to resolve this whole matter, both to both of our satisfaction. And I was very impressed with the quality of the competence and the experience that the mediators brought to the table. They were very effective at seeing what the real issues and real interests at stake were, and to help us kind of chart a course to a kind of amenable solution. it was, as I've been reflecting on this, I think part of the success of this is the fact that it really is a kind of non-adversarial context where you bring your problems there and you're both parties, both myself and the other party, as well as the new owner who was purchasing and is my current tenant for that space. All three of us were there, well aware of the fact that the volunteers who were donating their time were doing so, you know, out of the goodness of their heart or whatever. But it was actually very, that increased the likelihood of finding a quick and a good solution because everybody was kind of working together. So I was just very impressed with the way the process worked, and happy to come here and say that I support this legislation. I'd like to see more of it. I think it could also serve as a wonderful model for other kinds of dispute resolution. So if there are any questions, I'd like to...
Thank you very much for coming. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Chief.
Chair Burdick and committee. I'm Chief Romley, Hillsborough Police Chief. Always pleased to be here, especially when I see my own senator, and I feel comfortable. And Senator Walker, I've worked with in the past. I heard you on the radio yesterday, Senator Walker. You didn't need mediation. You did great.
Well, thank you. With Clark Larson, you could always use a little mediation.
I was impressed.
Getting a word in edgewise.
I'm impressed.
It's an accomplishment.
Congratulations. I'm here today to give you a snapshot of a working mediation program, and it's interesting, the history for Hillsborough and how we've developed it. We have had it for over 8 years, and we've had 550 cases that have been adjudicated or gone through the mediation program with 87% success rate. Each mediation is documented, and when I say each one, that's a minimum of perhaps 2 hours face-to-face with two mediators and then your disputing parties. So you multiply all those numbers, and the bottom line is we have fewer repeat calls. When we say 87%, it means the disputants have stopped the misbehavior or the dispute. It could be a property settlement issue. It could be a landlord-tenant. Could be barking dogs. The majority of police work, people need to understand, is service calls and code enforcement. Hillsborough now has this program through this through the mediation funding that we have received from the state. We are able to send our people to 32-hour training and then 32-hour advanced training. Now, we've had over 55 volunteers. Last year, we reported 6,866 hours of volunteer in the mediation program alone. And that translates from $17.33 to $118,900. We received from the state $26,000 to help fund that training. So they sit down and they go face-to-face training for 32 hours, the volunteers and the employees. So out of 150 employees, over 70% are trained in mediation, including myself. I had to go through it. It was great. It was right during labor contract negotiation. Union still got more, but it was good. It was a good experience. So we're doing these. So to give you a snapshot, today, a 911 call might, now that we have so many trained members of our department, sworn and non-sworn, they may go to two neighbors aren't getting along. It was a 911 call, but we want to divert it from the criminal justice system, and that's what you've heard here. One case was a criminal justice system. The McGrindle case was diverting it from a dispute. What we try to do is get people to go to a safe location, a third-party location, where they can resolve these. The program and the model that we're using in Hillsborough has now evolved into truancy reduction, and with the which is a very unique program in the state of Oregon. We have taken the mediation program, met with the Hillsborough School District. We have had 12 truancy mediations, and Patty Williams, our program director, tells me we have 20 pending. Now, when I say truancy, we're talking 20, 30 hours, or 40 hours of truancy, or 50 hours of truancy. These are very, very significant and greater. So what we've done is, what we realize is that the mediation program has become kind of organic in how it's spreading and extending. It strengthens partnership, not just with the schools now, but keep in mind we're also using volunteers. They have their own cubicle. When we built our new building last year in Hillsboro, we asked City Council for a spot for the volunteers who run the mediation program. And we were fortunate to have that site. And on any given day, you'll see a volunteer sitting there filtering through the calls that they've received, non-emergency, seeking for mediation, because we also go out on public access TV. So to summarize, what we're trying to do is to continue with the program, and once you see it working, as you've just heard testimony, where else can we use it? And the school district has now found it with the truancy program. Hopefully we'll be able to report back more success, but we find out that the skills that you're using, the communication skills, the interpersonal communication skills, are key to good old-fashioned community policing that you hear so much about. Another point, there is a House bill pending, there are a few, pending that deal with expanding training for police. And on one of them, House Bill 2037, I'm not testifying on that, but I want you to know, it is going to deal with requiring additional training for law enforcement to interact with people that encourage cooperation. What is that? It's mediation. That's exactly what it is. Now, it's good if this becomes a requirement, because over 70% of our department has already had this type of training. So again, as a snapshot for Hillsboro, this gives you an example of a senior program now working, could not have started without the assistance of mediation, dispute resolution commission, and unfortunately with that breaking it up, but yet having the University of Oregon and Portland State has now taken in going forward, we see more life in it. But this gives you an example of how much we depend upon it as an agency on a daily basis. And of course, I invite any committee member, if they ever want to go down to visit, see it in action. It's amazing to see people that just don't like each other, neighbors getting along, at least coming to some resolution. And people always say, well, what do you get them to do? Do they hug? No. What they do is they stop the misbehavior, but it's interest-based. Is it better to have, you know, the police not coming to your door all the time? Is it better to resolve these disputes and divert it from the criminal justice system as much as you can? And that's the spirit of what I want to leave you with, is this actually diverts an awful lot that clogs up if we don't divert it. As you know, the court system, the cost, and the emotional cost, and of course the violence. How many times have you heard of violent contact between neighbors not getting along with each other over a barking dog or a speeding car or misbehaving teenagers who are usually acting out on behalf of their parents, I might add. That's what we kind of find out. The kids are just kind of surrogates for mom and dad who don't like their next-door neighbor. How many times do you see that happening? That's why we believe in it so much, and we do ask the committee to take a look at how it works in one community, just as an example. I see Senator Ringo's here. Beaverton has a very good program as well that's very, very active in trying to resolve disputes. So to summarize, I ask that the committee looks at the need for this on a longer-term basis, because it sustains and supports the community with a huge volunteer component. And you really couldn't ask for a better type of program. And as I go to the budget committee tomorrow night, we're going to be able to talk about how we use some state funding to assist our local. Because a lot of times when you go to a local budget, it is, what does the state want from us now or requiring us to do without money? Tomorrow I'm going to report the state is giving us funding, has for the past 8 years, to allow us to sustain this program. We always make a pitch on the mediation program to kind of minimize at times the criticism that we don't get anything from Salem, just mandates to do more without any money that goes along with it. So I do appreciate the committee looking at this, and I trust that you will support. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there questions, comments from the committee? Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
Okay, we now have three more people testifying here, and I'm going to murder this first name, but Bia Hisu Sidlik, Rennell Schenkel, and Rich Angstrom. How bad was it?
Close.
Close, all right.
Not exactly murder.
Okay, good. This is the criminal committee, so. Start with you so I can find out how to pronounce your name.
Okay, great. Thank you. I am Belissa Seidlick, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Family Law Senior Policy Analyst with the Oregon Judicial Department. And I'm here on behalf of Nancy Miller, Deputy State Court Administrator, who is down in our budget hearings and regrets she can't be here today. I wanted to speak to the Dash 1 amendments, and while the department probably wouldn't have objected to them as originally misinterpreted, it is true, as Ms. Gordon testified, that the understanding between the proponents and the department is that, at least for the 05-07 biennium, the courts will be receiving $800,000 from the dispute resolution account. During that time, the proponents and the department will be engaging in discussions and investigations about alternative funding sources that may be utilized in order to continue the funding of the court's mediation programs and services. And just wanted to make it clear that, for the record anyway, if there are no available options that can be discerned after vigorous discussion and exploration, the department would be wanting to come back to this body and have it reconsider the appropriation of sufficient funds for the courts to continue their programs.
Thank you very much. Questions, comments? Okay, Ronell.
Afternoon. Pardon my end of laryngitis here for the
Most
record.
Most of us are like that, right, already.
Don't make me laugh, I speak. For the record, I'm Ronell Stankel, Policy Project and Legislative Coordinator for the Attorney General, and I'm here testifying on behalf of Attorney General Hardy Myers today. I believe your committee staff distributed a letter from Hardy himself to members just now, and I will just say for the record briefly that we are here in support of this bill with the Dash 3 amendments. I will note that the Attorney General was not able to have the Dash 3 amendments in his hands this morning when he drafted that letter, so the attachment you have was the draft that went down from Mr. O'Leary. However, I've checked them, and they match word for word, so it would be one and the same text. The Department of Justice, briefly, in accordance with ORS 183-502, encourages the use of collaborative problem solving. Our role is to work specifically with state agencies, of course. Our focus is on legal assistance to those agencies when they are using this service and this mechanism. We develop model ADR rules, specifically looking at confidentiality and the effectiveness of the final agreements on behalf of state agencies, and then we also keep an eye to statewide issues and overall coordination. We would like to thank Greg Wolf and Elaine Hallmark and others who worked with us on the Dash 3 amendments. And I also want to point out to you in the letter that not only is the Department of Justice in support of the bill with those amendments, but also the Department of Administrative Services. We coordinated those amendments with them, and they too are in support.
Thank you. Coordinate, that's a good word, isn't it? Okay, are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Mr. Angstrom.
Good afternoon. My name is Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. We're a trade organization that deals with the construction materials industry, asphalt, concretes, and aggregates, and we're basically the foundation for the building our Oregon roads. One of the things, I don't really have a sense of the issues around this particular bill with the committee, but I can, what I can address is the example that ended up from last session that ended up in the public process, the Oregon Consensus Program, and the dispute resolution process there that Elaine was talking about. As many of you know, we probably had one of the tougher environmental bills last session with trying to restore a bunch of the small sand and gravel sites around the state, and we were faced with quite a conflictual situation during the session where we had essentially farmers on one side with 1,000 friends and some of the environmental organizations. Industry was on the other side with the counties and the cities and many of the state agencies. And we were not able to reach a resolution on the Senate side to resolve that particular debate. It ended up in quite a mess for many of the aggregate producers around the state that provide the materials for Oregon roads. The industry met with Governor Kulongoski after session and asked that he begin a mediation process to try to resolve this issue. And where we ended up was the Oregon Consensus Program. And the industry has not been unfamiliar with the program. We've used it on an individual site-by-site conflicts. As you know, many of you from Eugene area know that there's aggregate can be pretty conflictual all around the state. But we have used it in the past on an individual site-by-site basis. But in this case, we use it to deal with the public policy around where we want our aggregate sites and how we're going to balance the issues surrounding aggregate and agricultural land. And the good news is the governor put this process together, and we've been mediating essentially since then. We are currently right in the middle of mediation. I think it's been going along pretty well. As you know, most mediation processes, especially after a session where everybody really hated each other, it took a while to kind of smooth things over. There was a lot of listening, a lot of talking, but I think we're now on a path to finding a resolution that will ultimately be presented to all of you in the Senate here. I have a unique perspective is that I actually came out of trial work before I came to this this present job. And, you know, I've listened to many of the speakers today talk about the mediation process on individual types of situations. But I have to say that after sitting through this on a big public policy argument, that it's not used enough in the legislative process. I really think it ought to be one of those options for legislators when you get into something like our aggregate bill from last year, 2413 or whatever it is. Amazing how those numbers stick to your brain. But that's not used enough, and it should be used more when the legislature cannot resolve things to try to get the different sides together. What you find out in the process, and especially with us in the farm community, is we have a lot more in common than we have against each other, and so that's been building some roads that I hope will end up coming to you with a solution where everybody's lined up. With that, it is important that you don't cut the legs out from underneath the mediation process and support Senate Bill 247. We need this process to continue. It's going to benefit all of you. If it falls apart, guaranteed, the farmers and the aggregate industry will be back in with a series of bills to make all your lives miserable again. And this is a good approach to resolving it in a more peaceful manner. Concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. Are there questions from the committee before this panel leaves? Thank you very much. That concludes our signed-up testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to speak on this? Come on up.
I was signed up, actually.
Okay, well, we just didn't get your sheet, so I'm glad glad I...
A couple extra minutes? Great. Maybe I hid my signature on the bottom somewhere. Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Cynthia Moore. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Mediation Association, which we call OMA, which is the state's only statewide organization which is focused solely on mediation and mediators. We are a nonprofit organization with nearly 400 members committed to the development, support, and advocacy of mediation in the state of Oregon. We offer mediators, academics, and mediation supporters an opportunity to join together to elevate the quality of mediation services and to expand the availability of mediation programs and services throughout the state. Since the last session, our board and the members have been working with and watching the development of the programs which moved from the former Dispute Resolution Commission to the University of Oregon School of Law and PSU's Hatfield School of Government. We're pleased to report that we've been impressed by the shift to these academic institutions and would like to see them supported beyond 2005. Both schools have made positive strides to further the original intent of the programs as established by the legislature in 1989. We believe that Senate Bill 247, with the amendments as discussed previously, involving the Oregon Judicial Department and the Department of Justice, will provide the people of Oregon with a viable and important alternative to the court system and administrative hearings. an alternative that empowers people to resolve their own conflicts and reach creative solutions to tough problems in their neighborhoods, their businesses, their families, and in their dealings with state and local agencies. These programs provide Oregonians with a low-cost alternative to solving their problems that, in many cases, would not exist without state support. We appreciate the support that many of you have shown in the past for these programs. Today, OMA asks that you support Senate Bill 247. In so doing, you'll allow these important programs to continue after January 2006, and you'll provide funding to community, public sector, and court mediation programs. On top of this, you'll confirm the need for all of these programs to work collaboratively to determine a mechanism for continued funding for the programs in the future. We look forward to working with you and the staff on the programs to make certain Oregonians continue to have access to a variety of effective tools to resolve their conflicts. Thank you for your time and for your support to Senate Bill 247.
Thank you for coming up, and your organization does very fine work. Thank you. Okay, that is our last witness, last call for more mediation witnesses here. Okay, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 247, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 247. And, Council, would you describe the Dash 1 Amendment, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The Dash 1 Amendment amends existing Section 4, and it adds to it by specifying that during the 2005-2007 biennium, that the fees that are allocated into the dispute resolution account are going to be distributed as follows. The first $800,000 will be distributed to the Oregon Judicial Department, and then of the remaining money, 65% will be distributed to the Oregon School of Law, and 35% will be distributed to the Hatfield School of Government, both for purposes of carrying out the respective dispute resolution programs.
Thank you. Is there any questions of council on this amendment? Senator Starr, would you have a motion on the Dash 1 amendment?
I would. Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 247.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 247. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Council, would you please describe the Dash 3 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The Dash 3 amendment to the bill clarifies that the Hatfield School of Government shall work cooperatively in designing its future programs with the Department of Justice and the Department of Administrative Services. And it also requires the Hatfield School of Government to notify the Department of Justice of any proposal to provide such services involving a public agency.
Thank you very much. Senator Starr, do you have a motion on the Dash 3 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 247.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 247. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, so at this point I would recommend a motion to refer this to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Senator Starr?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 247 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 247 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We're done with this phase. Thank you. And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 247. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 262.
Madam Chair, thank you, members of the committee. Senate Bill 262 would repeal the sunset that is set for an exemption to the public records statute involving records identifying individuals engaged in animal research at Oregon Health and Sciences University.
Thank you. We have signed up here. Surely we have signed up.
I know we have Leslie Halleck signed up. I'll bet we have Brian Berenger signed up, too. Just take a wild guess here. Here we go. Oh, I was right. Leslie Halleck, Jim Newman. You guys together? Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I understand that another person who wants to testify may be under a tight timeline, Mr. Tom Gallagher. So if it pleases the Chair, I'd be happy to defer to him if he needs to go first.
It's up to you. Would you care to avail yourself of that, Mr. Gallagher?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Halleck. I appreciate the courtesy. I have an industrial lands group that I chair. Starts at 2:30.
I see.
I'm Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. As we did 2 years ago, we have no objection at this point to this bill. But I would like to take a second to explain the position of the Newspaper Association on a public records bill. We apply this following set of principles to every bill that has to do with public records, and I expect to be in front of this committee this session a number of times on public records bill. The first is we think that every action of government ought to be available to the public, that every record should be there. We do recognize there are exceptions to this, that there are either individual privacy policies or other public policies that would require that some actions or some activities or some records be kept from the public under the general records law. We think these exceptions, we always generally recommend that they be in 192.501, which has with it a public interest balancing test, so that a record that's exempted from public disclosure still goes through a process and a legal challenge and can be brought, can be disclosed to the public under that section. Whenever we're looking at an exemption like this one, we apply again another set of conditions. We look at the magnitude, the breadth of the exception, how much information is going to be kept from the public, and secondly, why? What's the problem that what's the public protection or the individual privacy policy issue that requires this information to be kept private? The third thing is we expect to have continuous review of these exceptions. Situations change, time changes. There are sometimes public policy reasons why, and we'll be in front of this committee later on some exemptions to public records, which we think ought to be made public, and we think there's a positive reason for that. And the fourth thing I'd say is here is that from the newspaper's part, we hope to establish a sense of credibility with this committee, that when we come in and talk about public records and ask about another look at the exceptions, that we have shown to you that we evaluate each of these situations in a very positive way, and hopefully that you will take our recommendations or listen to our opinion on those records. The last thing I want to say is there's a couple of issues we don't like to get into on public records. We don't like to distinguish between, we don't like to define what is the media. If it should be available to the public as a whole and the media as representatives of the public should have access to this records. And that's where the balancing test sometimes comes into play. The second thing is we don't like a definition of media. It'll be impossible for us ever to define when a website, when somebody's active group is different from the Eugene Register Guard or the Hillsborough Argus, etc. So as you're going through this bill, I think there's some issues on along those lines may be raised. In conclusion, just let me say that we think this is a very narrow exemption. We think that there are public policy reasons to make this exemption. We have spent some time with the Health Sciences Center reviewing other ways to do this, and we can't find another way to protect these people. If the committee has another way, we'd be happy to look at it, but we have tried. So given our reluctance to ever put exemptions to the public records law, public records into law, on this one, again, I think we are saying we understand the reason for this exemption.
Thank
be happy
you.
To answer any questions.
Are there questions of Mr. Gallagher so he can get on his way here? Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Thank you again. Thank you.
Now, Dr. Howe.
Madam Chair and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I have provided you with a packet of material, and I'll very quickly highlight what's contained in that package. The first item is a memorandum from me to you. It's a letter summarizing OHSU's request to extend the sunset on Senate Bill 262, a law that helps OHSU protect our researchers from intimidation and harassment.
Can you put your name in the record, please?
I apologize. For the record, my name is Leslie Halleck. I'm the provost at OHSU. This letter that you have is requesting that you extend the sunset on this law so that we can protect our investigators. The law does so by exempting from public disclosure simply the name and location of the scientific and support personnel, community volunteers, suppliers and vendors, private funding agencies, support companies, whose research involves the use of animals other than rodents. For your information, 90% to 95% of our research that involves animals uses rodents. That's not involved in this exemption at all. The continuation of this law is required because we're experiencing, as are many similar entities, an escalating and widespread trend where those opposed to the use of animals are using intimidation, physical violence against scientists, science administrators, members of their family. Animal rights activists have hunted these people down in their homes, have bombed their cars, and have invaded their offices. Since the passage of last session's bill, OHSU scientists and their young children have been terrorized in their homes as a result of website solicitations where animal rights activists have encouraged such action. One OHSU scientist had her name put on wanted posters, which is an oft-used strategy that extreme movements will use to terrify professionals and try and discourage them from that field. As we hope to show you, just touching on the items in your packet, we've used this, it is a very narrowly defined law, and we've used it very prudently to protect just the safety of these people. The content of their work is available, the protocols, the treatment, all of that is available, just their names and locations. We have used it in a responsible way that honors the needs of the press. It has never been used to deny the press a press request for information. In your packet beyond the memo is a document entitled Animal Research Information Requests. This lists, in fact, all the public record requests that we have received since House Bill 3093 was passed 2 years ago. It lists all the requests for information related to research involving non-rodent animals, and it also indicates all the cases where we redacted. And at the very end, there's a sort of summation, I believe, and there were 24 requests, and in only 5 cases were those names redacted. In every case where press requested information, all of the information was provided. I did want to draw your attention to a list called Animal Activism at OHSU. It's a table that looks like this. That document just highlights some, although not all, of the recent activities directed at our employees at OHSU over the past year and a half. It lists the dates and details of some of the harassment and acts, usually at someone's home, often at night, when they're known to be involved in animal research. Next, we've provided a website of Independent Media Center that looks like this, and you will see several pages of material that's redacted. We've crossed out the name of our individuals with the exception of President Kohler, who allowed his name to remain visible, and an investigator by the name of Dr. Nuringer. She's been targeted so many times that she thought there was little value in redacting, and we should just share it with you. This is a game. It's called Connecting the Dots, and the idea is that they're inviting people to match the home address with the investigator, and then encourages them to visit these homes at specific times. In fact, this was a game played in October that encouraged events on Halloween night. It was followed, these suggestions, through the people on their list, their families and neighbors who are harassed. They use bullhorns. They put menacing material in their neighbors' mailboxes, and in fact we've had some of their children traumatized by this. So it's a very frightening experience when your home is targeted in the middle of the night. Another person, some of the suggestions in these websites are becoming more and more aggressive. A woman in England by a similar group that's active in Portland desecrated a gravesite, actually removed the remains of an individual. So these things can take on kind of strange and very difficult forms. We've listed for you another document that's taken from the website of a group called SHAC. SHAC stands for Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty. This is a group that's targeted an international drug testing firm that's called Huntington Life Sciences, HLS, or Huntington Life Sciences. They conduct animal research on drugs. And SHAC is behind the most violent animal rights campaign in world history. On behalf of this group, SHAC activists in the United Kingdom have attacked executives with baseball bats. Here in the United States, they've terrorized families, firebombed offices, invaded offices, vandalized cars, and put children on websites, notified people as to where the children's home schools are, and so on. The specific SHAC, and this just lists their activities over 2004. Headlines include things like homes painted, cars stripped. One of these is a Portland event. You may also see in the next pack another website that's really a call by SHAC for a weekend of action. They are calling activists in Oregon to attend a series of East Coast events. Comments posted on the website referred to taking a cue from SHAC and specifically mention OHSU. Finally, this is just a picture of the poster of Dr. Nuringer. This poster, which is a fairly common tactic, a sort of wanted poster, was put all over our clinics. It was put all over Reed College because that's where her husband works, and on the doors of their home. They live in a fairly rural area, and in the evening they were visited, and these were plastered on her home. So we're asking you to consider this sunset extension in order to redact the names and the location of these individuals, not the content of their work. And as I say, full disclosure to the press has been done in every instance. I also wanted to submit for the record a letter from the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association in support of these amendments. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And you, if you didn't mention, maybe I missed it, the how you've handled requests. Just because you have the authority to keep this information confidential doesn't mean you always do. That aren't there cases where you, like from media that you know are actually media, even though they're not mentioned in the bill as singled out, but where you know there's not a danger, you actually do use your discretion to release the information requested.
Indeed, in every case when the media has requested information, we have given it to them. We have redacted nothing when from a media request. There were 24 requests here. There were 5 redactions, and every media request was complied with in full. So we believe we've exercised extreme responsibility in this. And it isn't our goal to withhold the information. It's really just to protect these individuals, especially in their homes.
Correct. And I would hope that you would continue keeping track of how information is handled, because the public records law is there for a reason, and
sure,
it's very good to have that documentation. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Newman.
Yes, Madam Chair and the rest of the committee. My name is Jim Newman, and I'm the communications coordinator for the Oregon National Primate Research Center. I'm merely here to answer any questions you may have. I really don't have any testimony at this time.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions of Mr. Newman? I guess there are none. Thank you. Now, for the other side of the story, Andrea Meyer from ACLU. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. For those of you who were in this committee last session, you know that we opposed the bill, and I'm here to oppose it again. I want to say from the outset that crimes directed at folks and the factors that are going on, the issues going on in our homes, we do not support. That's not acceptable. To the degree it's criminal activity, it should be pursued entirely. But our objection is that this change to the public records law does nothing to affect the protections necessary. And among other things, the testimony you heard was continued incidents of harassment in the home. Oregon law, the public records law, already before this bill was enacted last session, allows for the person's name, for their home address and personal information to be kept out of the public records. So despite the reading of this statute, let's be clear that some of those protections already exist. The name of the researcher is important, and removing it from the public record fully dismantles the ability of legal watchdog groups from holding public animal research accountable to compliance with federal law and public expectation of animal safety and humane treatment. This won't stop the individuals who want to do harm. We see that. But it will and does stop lawful organizations from doing their job on our behalf. Legitimate watchdog groups rely on access to names of researchers to track individuals who have a history of abusive behavior towards research animals. Sadly, that exists. When public funds are used, the public does have the right to ensure that its dollars are not being used in the wrong way. As I testified last year and provided you, excuse me, last session, and I'm not going to today, it's important to remember one aspect. OHSU continues to post not just the names of researchers on their website, but their photographs. And I'm sorry, but I can't find a better way to be able to identify someone by additionally providing their photograph. A few other points I want to make. Investigating reporting by local media has identified abuses in OHSU research of monkeys that I testified 2 years ago on. Only by having the name of the researcher whose monkeys were self-mutilating was a reporter able to track down and report to the public the serious animal abuses going on at OHSU. 2 years ago, testimony was submitted by John Trogg from Willamette Week. He couldn't be here, but in part he said, in our extensive reporting on OHSU's primary research, and this was before the law was changed, we found that almost every request for public records was met with delay and denial. On several occasions, we found it necessary to involve our lawyer in the process to get what was clearly public records. The reason for the resistance became obvious once we finally got the records. They showed that both internally and externally, there were scientists who were questioning how monkeys were being treated. Practice such as sperm-gathering technique called, electroejaculation, that led to extensive self-mutilation among the male monkeys, was exposed, and it was only after these criticisms were published and under pressure from the USDA regulators that the Primate Center changed some of its procedures. Many of these records would not have been available to us had the proposed law, the law that we have today, been available. I believe that the real purpose of this law has had the power for OHSU to restrict access to those who want to criticize the organization. And I want to point you to the document they've provided you today. First, in their testimony, they indicate that what the information they don't want to give is what they need is the information linking a person, scientists, with specific detailed descriptions of procedures with the care and use of the animals. Such information, they state here today, used out of context and twisted without regard to truth, scientific accuracy, is then used to fuel support for intimidation and violence. I might suggest it's also used to get out and communicate ideas about concerns of animal research by many people. The examples on the sheet they gave you, I've had a chance, because they were kind enough to give this to me yesterday, to review this a little more carefully. I'm quite disturbed by the additional comment sections that they provided. I'm pleased that they've done this so you can see. But only those non-media folks representing, making requests, is there additional comments. In the sheet, there's only one additional comment. It's on page 3. That points out someone who, and it's the bottom one, the Primate Freedom Project. They say the director of this group has sent menacing letters to OHSU researchers in September 2003 claiming your elimination is justified, you are a cancer. That is only one. There are a number of requests by other individuals. Michael Budke, he's defined as an animal activist group, Stop Animal Exploitation Now. The additional comments? Mr. Budke has spread false, damaging rumors about OHSU animal care in the past. If you look at his various requests, any information provided to him was redacted. PETA. PETA is described as, in the past, PETA has spread damaging but false information about OHSU animal care. Again, information redacted for them. We're not talking...
Senator Brzezinski.
Can you explain when you say information redacted? I mean, my understanding of the bill is supposed to be, and the law that's in place is supposed to be only the names tied to the research. I mean, they're still providing the information regarding what the research is and those type of programs that are being conducted by the university, aren't they?
Chair Burdick, Senator Brzezinski, I can only tell you what they're providing under here. They say that they have asked NIHA to redact names of non-rodent animal researchers and clients. They also say below in the entries on page 3, when it comes to the last two entries, requested that NIH redact names of non-rodent animal research clients and security information under 3093. I don't know the scope of that and what it means. Let me give you an example of why we think the names are so important. And again, I really want to reiterate that the names and their photos are up on the website, but it's making a link. There are thousands of primates up there. If you are, whether you're media or whatever, because the public records law does not distinguish, if you are concerned about treatment of animal A, B, and C, those, you have the identity of the monkeys, and you want, and you've got some, you've looked at the medical records and there's a problem with them, and you want to know who the researcher is, under this law, they can deny it. Now, what might be the use of that name? Well, what if it's researcher Joe Smith? And indeed, researcher Joe Smith was in another state 2 years ago engaging in even more abusive behavior, and he's come here now. We might want to whistleblow. The public might want to know that. And so to know the name to tie to the animals can be important in the public's right to know when there are egregious actions going on.
Well, but you point out that the names of the primary researchers are available, but what about the janitors and the cage cleaners and people like that?
Chair Burdick, I think the ACLU's primary concern in this is the name of the researchers, and that's the area we're most concerned with being eliminated from it. Those are the people who are out on the website already, whose photos are already available, and the ones engaging in the research practices. And to the degree that that is our primary concern about them being included in this bill, that's where our concern most lies.
Well, we have an amendment before us that may help at least a little bit on some of that.
Chair Burdick, I've seen that amendment. Mm-hmm. My understanding of what this amendment does not help us.
Okay.
What I understand it to be, and then I'll say why I'm not sure it does anything, and I'm actually surprised that this would already have been allowed to be redacted, is if they put the information up on the website, if they issue a report with Joe Smith and his name and photo, and a year goes around and someone does a public records request, actually it's not a report, excuse me, it's just the website and I think some press releases that they create themselves. If it's a year later and you want that, you can get that public, well, it's a public document to begin with, but it's already been released out into the stream. It's consciously been released. It's a website or a press release. Apparently, without this amendment, that meant that if it's a year later and you requested that, depending on apparently who you are, they would redact the name of a press release, the name of the researcher on a press release or on the website. So,
I don't think that was the intent. I think this just clears it up. I never got the impression that that was the intent. But nevertheless, I digress. Go ahead with
so, that's my primary focus today, is that this seems to be and has been used to restrict and sort of punish those who appear to be the nonviolent animal rights groups. There's no evidence of violence by them asking for information, and there are comments about that they spread damaging or false information. That's what the press and the public do when they want to bring things to the attention. And to use that as a basis to deny them access to the same information they are giving the press sets a very dangerous distinction that does not exist in our public records law. It is the public, not simply the media. And we would urge you not to support this and to seriously consider amending at least the names of the researchers out there who are doing this work.
Thank you. Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Meyer, I save a collection of bills from each session that I think are going to come back. I think this is one I saved, so could you please tell me the bill number, and I'd like to look at the testimony from last session.
Sure, and I've got copies. Senator Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, it's House Bill 3093.
House Bill 3093.
3093.
Yeah, I did save that one because, you know, your testimony is very similar to what it was last session, and I just want to take a look at what my questions were back then.
Right. Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, I couldn't speak. I think you opposed it.
I did, and I want to ask myself again why. I mean, I've listened to the testimony again today. They also, in this bill, if I understand it correctly, Madam Chair, want to extend it to the suppliers, and last session we did not do that.
Chair Burdick and Senator Walker, I mean, I haven't caught that. I do want to point out one of the things, and I think this is from my testimony 2 years ago, and you're probably remembering this, was that it was watchdog groups that exposed the fact that OHSC was buying dogs and cats from an animal shelter, and that was exposed. It was Clackamas County Animal Shelter was selling dogs and cats trees for research, and we believe that would have been impossible. Well, it would be under this to identify who is providing the animals and as such determine where they're coming from, and if they're coming from animal shelters, and is that a policy that we want to have going, and is that public information that we should all be able to decide as a community whether that's acceptable?
The supplier, Senator Walker, where are you looking on that? I don't see that.
I read that somewhere.
Don't to the actual language from last session.
I can look at you all. There's no change.
No, this is the same language.
Change, it's the same one?
It's the same language.
Yeah, it's the same language as last.
Very broad.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, and I remember the success of this bill last session too, Ms. Meyer, as you must. So,
right.
I mean, you're climbing a hill.
Right. I mean, Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I appreciate the information that's been provided to this committee by OHSU and the very scary and criminal tactics that are being directed at them. And I'm not sympathetic to those actions that are being directed at them. We do not support that. But I really have concerns when they do put the information up on the website, as they should, and then they come in here and want to have the ability, and they shouldn't be doing the ones guarding the public records, clearly. I look at this and I was appalled that kind of, and I mean, I'm pleased that they put down these notes, but that's not relevant to who's requesting a public record, that they spread rumors or they provide damaging information. That's really irrelevant to someone seeking a record in our public records. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Thank you very much. Okay. Is there anybody else here who wants to sign up? Mr. Behringer.
Yeah. Thank you. For the record, Brian Behringer, government relations with OHSU, and we just missed a small step, and so I just want to catch folks up. There's a -1 and a -3 amendments that we didn't really go over, and the bill was drafted as a permanent repeal of the sunset. That was not the intention. That was a mistaken draft. And so the -1 amendments simply extend the sunset another 4 years, where we will once again participate in the record-keeping actions that we've done this time around, just to help with people's comfort level. The -3 amendments were the other amendments that Ms. Meyer was just referencing, and these were amendments that were drafted at the request of Mr. Gallagher, and they were to help with some of his folks, some comfort language, and so I just wanted to make sure that that was accurately attributed and explained.
And the -3 amendments are the ones that make it clear that if it's something has been in a press release or a website, that it can't be redacted.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you very much for clarifying that. Okay. Anybody else? Thank you. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 262. and open a work session on Senate Bill 262, and we have a dash one amendment. Council, you can describe it, but that's basically the sunset provision.
Correct. It repeals, it extends the sunset to January 2nd, 2010.
Okay. Thank you. Committee, I ask that the sunset not be repealed on this, that it be extended for another 4 years, because it would be good to, this is a very controversial area of public policy, and I want to continue to monitor it to make sure that legitimate public information is not being withheld. Okay, and we also, let's just go one thing at a time. Senator Starr, would you have a recommendation?
Madam Chair, I move dash one amendments to Senate Bill 262.
Senator Starr has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 262. Is there any discussion? Mm-hmm. Any objections?
That dash one puts the sunset back in. I don't have an objection to that.
Okay, thank you. Without objection, dash three amendments again make it clear that the press releases and websites information cannot be redacted. Senator Starr, do you have a?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 262.
Senator Starr has moved the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 262. Senator Beyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, and maybe this can be done with council to do this, but I think someone needs to take a look, because the dash one amendments deletes everything except for the relating to clause on this bill, and there is no place to put the dash threes left once the dash ones have been adopted, because that is no longer part of the bill. Part of the bill just becomes the sunset.
We've done this before. I know we've done this before.
I think that it can probably be reconciled with the council. I think I just want to make sure that it's on the record that the two
that
aren't really compatible as they're printed.
Well, maybe we should have moved the dash three first.
Yeah.
And then that would be part of the bill.
Well, it wouldn't work that way.
It doesn't matter, because the dash one eliminates the whole bill. I think if we adopt the dash threes, I think legislative council can reconcile them, but I just want to make sure that someone knows some of that.
That's correct, because when it comes out A engrossed, then this will be part of the content, and
the dash one is printed is not going to work, because the bill is going to have to remain intact, because this is getting tacked on to the end of the bill. Mm-hmm. So you're amending the bill, not deleting the bill.
Madam Chair, I would have a suggestion. Because I don't want to vote on this bill today until I review House Bill 3093, and you could get a dash two amendment that fixes all your problems so that you don't have a problem when the bill goes out of committee.
That's probably a good idea under the circumstances, and then you can have some time to review. The testimony was very similar. I remember it pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we will. Why don't we? See, we have put in the dash three amendment already. Dash one amendment already. Senator Starr, would you be willing to move to withdraw the to delete the dash one amendment from this bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would rescind the previous motion to move the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 262.
Okay, we'll do that first. Senator Starr has rescinded his moved to rescind his motion to add the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 262. Discussion without objection. Senator Starr, a motion perhaps to delete the dash one amendment, which you had already put in there.
Madam Chair, I move to rescind the...
Delete. Now we need to delete the dash one amendment, because that already went in.
Okay. All right. I move to delete the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 262.
Senator Starr has moved to delete the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 262. Is there discussion? Objection. So ordered. So what we're left with here is an unamended version of Senate Bill 262, so we will work with Legislative Council to get the intent of the Dash 1 and Dash 3 amendments in there and bring this puppy back. Thank you. Okay, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 262. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 293. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 293 would repeal the statute that requires NPSCs to submit a report to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission every biennium regarding details of the county's early disposition programs.
Oh, Craig. Craig Pence. Signed up.
Man, I said if I could start.
Yeah. Senator Pryszynski, is he testifying?
Yeah, this is actually a bill that I put in for the Lane County District Attorney's Office. Kent Martimore, who's the chief deputy, is in the back room available for questions if necessary. We've submitted testimony as to the dilemma that the Lane County District Attorney's Office and, my belief, other district attorney's offices are faced with because of the delegation of the responsibility of making these summaries of the dispute resolution type of programs. We had in Lane County, which still has its DAP, the Deferred Adjudication Program, putting all that information together has fallen on the shoulders of the district attorney's offices through most of the state because it's coming from the local PSAPs, the Public Safety Coordinating Councils. And what they've asked for is because of the limited resources that they have, plus probably just as important, for those counties that are actually responding and sending the material as required to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, it's basically being stored by the commission and not being utilized for any other purpose, but just taking up shelf space because no one's actually trying to recoup or utilize that information. I can tell the committee that the DAP program actually started when I was still in the DA's office, and we actually had a district court. We were looking for ways to cutting cost and handling some of these low-level non-person offenses, and that's how that program actually got started. Mr. Martimore is here. He can also talk about another program called the Blue Sheet Specials that we run as to the arraignment ARAMA. And so if you have any questions regarding how some of the programs work in at least one of the district attorney's offices, he's here to respond to that, as well as the workload that is placed on his office to be able to comply with the current requirements that were put in place by the 2001 legislature, and at this point really draining resources away from handling cases in the courtroom.
Mr. Martimore, would you like to join us up here? Thank you. Mr. Prince.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I had not signed up because I knew it was Senator Pryszynski's bill. I just wanted to be here to basically echo that we get a report from about half the counties, maybe. Mm-hmm. They vary very much as to how much data are in them, and we really don't have staff to do much with them. So we try to put a report together, but I think as far as resources, we don't have resources either to do anything with them. That's to take nothing away from the programs themselves, because I think they are good programs.
Do you want to add to that?
Kent Martimore from the Lane County District Attorney's Office. I've summarized our office's position in the written material that's been provided for you. I think I'd rather just answer questions because I'm assuming that you have had or will have an opportunity to go through that. And Senator Pryszynski did a good job of summarizing, I think, where we're coming from.
And the other thing I would say is that I had a conversation with Mr. Prince. If we as a legislature wanted to actually see what was happening, we could put the request out to the commission. They could then in turn go to the district attorney's offices or to the local PSAPs and ask them for that data, for that snapshot, as compared to having this basically being done on a regular basis for, it appears to be, for no useful purpose at this time.
Okay, so basically this bill would not interfere with your ability to
to gather that kind of information. Is that correct?
That's correct. I think that as the legislature and the governor focuses the commission, you could certainly focus the commission on this or any other thing, but to do it every biennium and not really have resources at the DA's office or the LIPSC or my office to do it each biennium, there's probably more important things that you'd want to have the commission do with our resources.
Thank you very much. Are there questions or comments from the committee? Senator Walker?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was looking at Mr. Mortimer's testimony, and he indicates the 2001 legislature enacted this bill, and I was here. I don't remember doing this, but we do quite a number of bills when we're here, and I guess we were a little concerned about wanting transparency and accountability in the program. Mm-hmm. We're not getting it because everyone's overburdened and understaffed. So if you say we can get this information otherwise, then I guess I'm okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there questions or comments from the committee? Thank you. For the comments from you? Okay. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 293, and I'm not getting terrible looks in Hartford, so we will open a work session on Senate Bill 293. Senator
Pozanski,
do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 293 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Pozanski has moved Senate Bill 293 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Senator Pozanski, you are carrier of the week. Would you like to carry it?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 293, and the Senate Judiciary Committee is adjourned.
And Commerce will be starting.